This is episode 62 of the Next Year Now podcast.
Hi, I'm Kaylee Place, a wellness coach and meditation teacher. If you're tired of feeling run down and wish you could attack every day with passion and excitement, then you need to start listening to the Next Year Now podcast with my friend, Tom Hefner.
It's natural to agree with the boss. It's natural to hide your mistakes. All of these things that are very natural, very human, very understandable are not a recipe for effective teaming. And so I think of leadership as the force that helps us do the unnatural.
Welcome to the Next Year Now podcast with Tom Hefner. Tom believes that if you really want to thrive at work and in life, then every day purposeful habits and practices are vital. The Next Year Now podcast will not only help you identify and integrate these habits into your daily life, but also bring you key insights and lessons from some of the most successful people in their fields. And here is your host, Tom Hefner.
Hello and welcome to the podcast devoted to helping you thrive at work and in life. The topic of habits and practices is always front and center in our discussion, but we also explore how we use these habits and practices to improve our personal development, productivity, creativity, health and well-being, business, and entrepreneurship. There's a big myth I want to dispel right now. It's this idea of the lone genius, the person that creates and develops amazing ideas and brings them to life alone, as the hero in the story. It's simply not true. Almost everything that's been accomplished, that's been worth accomplishing, has been in the presence and with the help of other people. It's called teaming. Today's episode won't discuss the myth, but we will talk all about teaming with the world's best expert on teaming, and that is Amy Edmondson. In our conversation, I'll be asking Amy to discuss her unique idea about teaming and how that's different from the conventional view of teamwork. Why teaming is more important now than ever before. The role of psychological safety in effective teams. This is really interesting. You're not going to want to miss this portion of the show. Book recommendations that will help 10x your organization's teaming and performance right now. And so much more. Before we start our conversation with Amy about teaming, I want to talk about our sponsor for today's episode, and that's because Tom Hefner Enterprises Innovation Training is sponsoring this week's podcast. One of the most important success metrics for organizations is how well they team. So exactly what we're going to be talking about with Amy. Unfortunately, that's not something you learn, really. You don't learn it in elementary school. You don't learn it in middle school. You don't learn it in high school. And you really don't learn it in college. You're just kind of presumed to magically know it. They say go off and team up together. What makes Tom Hefner's innovation training so effective is that he teaches you concrete methods to improve and accelerate your teaming and collaboration. If you want to learn more, then go to tomhefner.com/work. You can read all about the innovation training and consulting work he does. Through his training, he's going to teach you how to team more effectively and how to create transformational ideas. But don't take his word for it. Check out his testimonials page and his client list. He works with leading companies like Accenture, Porsche Car, and Starbucks, to name just a few. Amy C. Edmondson is the Novartis Professor of Leadership and Management at Harvard Business School. She teaches and writes on leadership, teams, and organizational learning, and her research has been published in leading academic and management journals. She's been recognized as a top management thinker by Thinker50 since 2011 and was awarded that organization's Talent Award in 2017. Her recent book, The Fearless Organization, reveals why psychological safety, and we're going to get into that in just a moment, at work is critical to success in a dynamic, fast-paced world. Newsflash, that's what the world we live in now. And Amy has received her PhD in organizational behavior, her AM in psychology, and AB in engineering and design. Shout out to all my engineering friends, all from Harvard University. So you know she's legit. Amy, thank you for joining us today and welcome to the show, my friend.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks, Tom.
I'm so excited about this conversation with Amy that I'm just going to jump right into it. There's no preamble. We're just going to jump right into this. Amy, one of the reasons I went back to graduate school at the University of Pennsylvania was to study the psychology of high performing individuals and teams. And this was back in, it was 2011, which, as I say that, time is flying. My wife and I have welcomed two more kids to our family since then, and it was crazy. But at the time, I was designing jammer systems that went out to Iraq and Afghanistan that protected our troops from improvised explosive devices, also known as IEDs. And basically, it created this electronic bubble of protection from RF-detonated IEDs. And our team was dealing with a lot of challenges. First and foremost, as you might imagine, the work that we did had real-life implications and consequences. And specifically, our work determined whether soldiers lived or died. And we also had incredible technical challenges, operational challenges, like the list goes on. And in that moment in time, it was kind of a crucible point for me. And it was the spark for me to go back to graduate school. So I didn't end up going and studying teaming like I thought I would, but I never forgot about that. And so when I came across your book, Teaming, How Organizations Learn, Innovate, and Compete in the Knowledge Economy, everything kind of just came flooding back in full circle for me. So with that in mind, I want you to think about, or I want to ask you about teaming and teamwork, because you have a new way of thinking about this topic. And share, if you would, how you think about teaming, teams, and teamwork. Because again, this is very different from most people.
Thank you. And I can only imagine, you know, the challenge and the intensity of the work you were doing, because, you know, they say those who can't do teach, or those who can't do research. So that would be me. and thank you. Thank you for that work that you did in keeping people safe. I too am particularly intrigued by the kinds of work where there really are high stakes, you know, life and death consequences. Mm-hmm. And in particular, I've done a lot of research in the healthcare delivery setting. So teams and teaming. Let me start with just a quick definition. You know, a team is a bounded, reasonably stable group of people who are interdependent in achieving some shared goal. We probably in the business world and the military world, you know, we got the word team from sports. The sports had it before we did. And I think we imported that word for good reason. Right, it's exciting to watch a sports team that performs really well. You intuitively recognize that the whole is more than the sum of the parts. And part of the reason is, of course, they practice and they get to know each other's strengths and weaknesses, and they develop a set of routines and moves that they can reliably execute on in different situations. They're able to do that for a few reasons. One is the people on the team have been well selected. They've been selected for their skill, for their attitude. And so there's a reason why that stability matters. You know, if you were on a pickup game in the park, you're not going to perform as well as a stable, well-balanced team. So here's the deal. When I go into organizations today, and including healthcare delivery, but certainly the military and so many others, I see fewer and fewer opportunities to build and create stable teams. We've got 24/7 operations. We've got challenging innovation projects where we don't frankly know in advance exactly what skills are going to be needed at what time. We don't have a blueprint. We don't know how to execute on something. So we have a lot of flow through. You know, we have different members at different times. And yet, we're still interdependent to achieve, you know, an important shared goal. And so I figured that needed a name, or at least we needed a way to talk about this, because there's a lot of talk about, oh, how do we have good teams? But what they really meant was, how do we do good teaming? Mm. Because more and more, you have people at work who need to coordinate and communicate with different people at different times, you know, without the luxury of a stable team. And so this seemed important, this seemed challenging, and I wanted to get my arms around it. And I wanted, you know, first and foremost, to help people think about the fact that teamwork, the phenomenon of, you know, of cooperation and creating more than the sum of the parts, can happen in those two very different contexts. It can happen in the context of a stable, well-designed team, and it can happen in the context of teaming among relative strangers.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'll say anecdotally, I've seen that shift in the last 5 to 10 years working at my older organization, the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory. So that's where we did all this work with the DoD and things like that. And it was funny because early on, you had really big projects, you know, Standard Missile 6, which will mean nothing to you necessarily, but basically these big budget projects where you had cohesive teams, stable teams over time. And now, whether it's the acquisition reform or just kind of the way that funding goes, or even just the nature of the threats that we face from a military perspective, it's very asymmetric that people have to come together for short periods of times that are very high intensity. And you really need to have those behaviors of teaming versus, like you said, the team itself is almost in some ways inconsequential.
Yeah, and I'm glad to hear that you see that shift too, because I certainly see it. And in the business world, we hear a lot about agile and agile teaming, and you know, again, that need to pivot and be flexible and turn on a dime. And in pharmaceuticals, there's more and more need for smaller targeted therapies that work for just small groups rather than the big blockbuster drugs of yesteryear, which were also developed in big budget, big projects. So a similar sort of, you know, hyper flexibility happening in different contexts.
Amy, help us think about effective teaming. So this show is, it's based on the belief that everyday habits and practices are key for us to thrive. And this is no different for teams. What are some concrete habits and practices that enable effective teaming?
Well, let's see. This will not really be a practice, but I think actually it won't sound like a practice, but it is a practice. This might sound like a strange place to start, but let me start with humility. I think that's actually a crucial practice for teaming. And the reason is if I'm not kind of constantly aware or constantly reminding myself that I don't know what you know, and I don't know everything, I don't have the answers, right? If I'm not sort of humble about what I bring, which is certainly not nothing, but it's not everything either, then I'm not going to be an effective teamer, because I got to approach any new situation with a certain amount of confidence with what I bring, but enormous humility about what I don't bring. And that, of course, leads to the next practice, which is curiosity. Or at least that's a state of mind, super important state of mind, and its corresponding practice, which is inquiry or asking good questions. So I think and can talk a lot about what's the nature of a good question, why is it so important to ask good questions, but these are two absolutely crucial practices that are going to help us get up to speed and collaborate effectively in a reasonably novel situation.
One thing I've always noticed is, and I'm 100% behind you on the curiosity inquiry. There's a really great HBR article, I'm sure you've read it, by Warren Berger, talking about the power of inquiry and asking good questions. Yes. But one thing I've always seen is that teams, their ability to be curious, their ability to explore that space, in a large way is influenced by leadership. And so I would maybe pose the question to you, what role do you think leadership plays in teaming in these behaviors?
A huge role. So if I back up just a minute and say, you know, what does it take for teaming to work? Because we can easily point to all the things that could go wrong. You know, when people who don't know each other very well, haven't worked together consistently over time, suddenly swarm together and have to do something that's consequential. And so it's worth saying something about the context. And two things I think are particularly important. One is that we have been asked to do something that matters, right? That there's a, or at least we believe it does. It could be a new breakfast cereal or a defusing an IED. But it matters. It's clear why we've come together. So that should be the context. You know, why we're needed, why our work is needed. And then the practices, which I already alluded to a little bit, of sort of interpersonal effectiveness and curiosity and listening and asking. And then, as you say, leadership. Leadership is so important. And here's why. Because the things we're now asking people to do are not natural, right? It's natural to you know, hold back your weird ideas in case someone won't like them. It's natural to agree with the boss. It's natural to hide your mistakes. You know, all of these things that are very natural, very human, very understandable are not a recipe for effective teaming. And so I think of leadership as the force that helps us do the unnatural. So leadership motivates and inspires, gives a rationale, gives feedback, but leadership also creates the space whereby good processes are followed, right? If nobody's asking any questions, leadership intervenes to ask some, create more of that opportunity for mutual learning.
One of the things I've seen leadership do really well, or when it's done well, I guess I should say, is mm-hmm. that people always say, be bold, or, you know, not I should always mm-hmm. say, but you mm-hmm. hear a lot of leaders say, be bold, take risks. And a lot of times I think leadership, they say that, they say one mm-hmm. thing, but then they do another thing. When you get in front of the executive team and all of a sudden you're throwing ideas out there and they're just getting crushed without any constructive criticism. And so they're not practicing what they're preaching. That is, hey, we want you to be bold. Like that's a great try. It's not there yet, right? Versus mm-hmm. kind of the more, I'll say, caustic critique. So mm-hmm. I think an equal part of that is, and it seems simple, but is to lead by doing, lead by example, and say, hey, listen, if we're going to say that it's, let's go and explore this space and take some risks, then we're going to allow you to take those risks.
Of course. Yeah, and if we're going to say, gee, we really want you to learn from failure, I'm going to have to go first. I'm going to have to raise my hand and say, hey, let me tell you about a failure I learned from.
Mm-hmm.
And so they lead by example. They walk the talk. They model the learning orientation that we're talking about that's so crucial for teaming. And, you know, that's huge. You know, in a funny way, it's easy to say leaders should lead by example, but it's, as I'm sure you know as well, it can be rare. It can be the exception rather than the rule. And it makes a huge difference. You know, there's actually research on this. When there's a gap between what leaders do and say, it's terribly demoralizing, right? It actually has a powerful effect on people's performance, not to mention their teamwork and collaboration.
Yeah, I liken it to parenting, right? Because as a parent, I can tell my kids, hey, be kind. You know, these are the values that matter in our family, kindness and respect.
Mm-hmm.
And I can say that till I'm blue in the face. But if they see me being disrespectful to the cashier at the store, if they see me being disrespectful to somebody, whether it's a friend or somebody they don't know, then they're not going to practice those values of respect and kindness. And I think it just goes the same way with leadership. If you want leadership, if leadership wants risk taking, then they need to show risk taking. If leadership wants to promote risk taking and say, hey, listen, it's okay to fail, then they need to show that it's okay to fail.
Right. And respect. I mean, I think respect is a good one. If our organization has a value of respect, and leaders show that they do not respect others, the value will not really take hold.
Well, let's flip this conversation the other way. We've talked about some of the things that will set the stage for effective teaming. What are some of the biggest barriers to effective teaming?
Well, one huge barrier, one that I've done a lot of thinking about recently, is a lack of what I call psychological safety. Because it's everything that we've been talking about so far is, in a way, inherently risky, at least interpersonally risky. You know, it's hard to admit a mistake. It's hard to offer an idea that I'm not quite sure is a good one.
Mm-hmm.
And so without a sense of psychological safety, it can be really hard. It can be hard to have effective teaming.
Well, in your newest book, The Fearless Organization, you discuss psychological safety in a lot of detail. For those of us that don't know what that is, can you share more about what psychological safety is and probably just as importantly, what it's not?
Sure. So psychological safety broadly is a climate, an environment in which people are comfortable expressing and being themselves. And that doesn't mean sloppy or let it all hang out. I mean, really just that it's okay to be candid, right? That I have a sense that my voice is valued and expected here. So they feel comfortable. People feel comfortable sharing their concerns and their mistakes without fear of embarrassment or retribution.
I think that's the missing link whenever we, so our organization did a lot of work or is trying to do a lot of work on making more diverse and inclusive teams. And because we know from at least some of the social psychology research that the more diverse, the more inclusive a team is, the better the outcomes, whether that's the, you know, the more effective performances, the more creative, et cetera, et cetera. And I think one of the things that's always interesting about that is if you bring people in that are very, very different or come from very, very different backgrounds, on one hand, it definitely puts you on your A game to say, oh, you know what? Like, I don't know this person. I better bring everything I've got. But if you're going to do that, I feel like you have to have some amount or a lot of psychological safety to feel comfortable doing that in the presence of other people that you don't know.
Absolutely. So let me back up just a little bit and say, yes, you know, we know with confidence that diverse composition in teams is going to be a source of effectiveness. However, it's not that straightforward. And that's the second part of your point with psychological safety, because in fact, there's very mixed results in the literature. Some studies that have been done have shown that diversity creates better performance. Meanwhile, others have shown that team diversity creates worse performance. And of course, the answer is it depends. And well, what does it depend on? Well, one really important thing it depends on is whether or not the team is set up to take advantage of that diversity. Right? The diversity we have is not necessarily the diversity we use. And the diversity we use is going to be heavily dependent on whether or not there's a climate of psychological safety. Right? So if I feel that I'm different from other people on this team, do I feel that I actually have a voice, that I can speak up?
Amy, I remember talking about teaming with my friend and former professor, Adam Grant, and he said something that struck me at the time. I don't remember his exact words, but it was something along the lines of good teams need to have the ability or the room to fail in their work. And when that risk-taking can happen, then the team can accomplish some really amazing things. But if that's true, then how do we start talking about failure in industries like where you work, healthcare or law, or even the work that I was doing in Iraq and Afghanistan, where failure could mean loss of life or millions of dollars?
It's such an important question, and I hope this won't seem like it's oversimplifying, but I think the key is to have the failures you need to have in a safe context so that you don't have them in the high-risk context. In other words, I mean, maybe the best illustration of this is pilots, aviation. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they have required and really important training time in simulators. And those simulators are programmed to put the pilots in a situation where it's really dangerous and really risky, where they very well may and often do fail. Why? So that they can, you know, learn great skills for dealing with such a thing if it ever happened in real life. So you want to have your failures in the laboratory. And what does that do for them? Well, it helps them not only understand some of the things that can happen so that in the real flight, they're well equipped to guard against them. But it also helps them understand and anticipate some of the things that could happen that emotionally most of us would not be really good at anticipating. So in places like healthcare or in the theater of war where the stakes are incredibly high and yes, life and death, it is absolutely crucial to have the discipline of offline processes where we really work through what could go wrong here, because that minimizes the risk of the failure happening. And that requires real interpersonal risk. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm going to sit with you offline, not in the battlefield, but offline, but say things like, I'm worried about this or what would happen to that, I'm taking interpersonal risks to bring those issues up. And I do it, and we do it because we know it's okay to fail in this setting. And we really, really, really want to avoid failure in the other settings. So in healthcare, people are increasingly being trained to be willing to report small errors and small mishaps, which traditionally would have been swept under the rug, for the very reason that We want to avoid the big life death problematic failures.
Well, in some of those industries like healthcare, for example, where maybe they haven't had high psychological safety, is low psychological safety, is that correlated with increased rates of burnout?
I think it is. And I actually don't have direct data on that. But here's why I think it's a valid hypothesis. Because when people have a lack of psychological safety, it's exhausting in a way, because you're cautious. It takes effort and energy to engage in impression management. Mm-hmm. It takes effort and energy to kind of, to size the place
That's
up.
That's a great term, by the way, impression management. I love that.
You bet. I mean, I'm just, okay, if I'm unable to relax my guard, I am more prone to burnout. I think that would be a great study for someone to do, by the way.
Well, so I asked that question because a friend of mine and I, Paula Davis Lack, we do a lot of work from our time in the University of Pennsylvania doing resilience training. And she's done a lot of work on burnout and that kind of intersection of burnout, teaming, and innovation. Mm-hmm. So maybe a different angle to another question to ask around that is, can team resilience also influence psychological safety?
Yes, I think that would probably be some kind of virtuous cycle. Right? The more psychological safety the team has, the more resilience it has. It's going to be resilient to and tough in the face of new challenges. And the more experience we have being tough in the face of novel challenges, the more we build up a reservoir of psychological safety.
That makes sense. Amy, before I move on, is there anything else from your books that you'd like us to know? I mean, in a perfect world, we'd have hours and hours to discuss, but we don't. But something I haven't asked you about yet, but you say, hey, listen, Tom, this is really important for all of you to know.
Sure. So, we've talked about the team dynamics and teaming and even, the burnout that can come from people not feeling able to bring their full selves to work. But it's probably worth just pointing out that this has huge consequences. We've already talked about life and death in the battlefield, in the hospital. But businesses also will live and die based on whether or not they are able to tap into the talent that they have on board. And in my book, I describe a handful of cases where companies looked to all the world like they were performing extremely well, but in reality, it was an illusion. And it was an illusion that top management perpetrated, not knowingly necessarily, not willingly, but because they were unaware of the degree to which people in their organizations were afraid to speak truth to power. That's an extremely dangerous place to be, whether you're worrying about the bottom line or worrying about, life and death decision making. It's an extremely risky place to be when you don't know the truth of what's really going on in a fast-paced world. So I just want to make sure it's clear to people that this issue of psychological safety is absolutely mission critical to organizations of all kinds, in a world where talent and knowledge play a bigger and bigger role.
Can you share one example we might know?
Sure. So one example is the VW Dieselgate case, the terrible story of what looked like the world's most successful auto company for a period of time. Good chunk of that success was based on a fraud, and not I think a fraud that was designed in from the beginning or anything like that, but a fraud created. And fraud, as listeners likely know, where engineers had designed software to defeat the regulators to make it look like the engines were passing emissions tests rather than actually passing them, because in fact the technology itself was not able to do that. But so afraid were they of telling their boss and their boss's boss that it couldn't be done, that just was apparently a more frightening proposition than just the fear of being caught cheating, that they chose the wrong path.
Yeah, I remember that. That was that was nuts. How far that went along.
Yeah,
I mean, it just shows you to the degree that how when you don't have that psychological safety to share and be honest and open, that how far that can perpetrate forward.
Absolutely, right? You think, okay, I can understand how kids in school might do that, you know?
Yeah.
They're afraid, they cheat on the test, right? But really, you know, adult, well-educated engineers, yeah, I mean, fear can be a very powerful and distorting emotion for people.
Here, just thinking along those lines, are there, when you think about psychological safety, and I think about some kind of iconic companies and I'll say iconic disruptors, somebody like Steve Jobs, who is famously, mm-hmm. he seems like a terrible person. I mean, obviously unbelievably brilliant and innovative, but seemed like a terrible person. And that culture seemed like it would be not one rife with psychological safety. How were they successful in the face of that? Or was it just that, you know, no, they were able to create psychological safety in a different way?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two responses to this question, because it's, I think many of your listeners can immediately think of companies that seem to be run by, you know, top-down dictators who aren't listening to anyone and are creating fearful workplaces, and go, but wait a minute, they succeeded. So there's a fallacy, first of all, of reasoning by, you know, single example. Mm-hmm. So if you think about, and you mentioned Steve Jobs, but if you think about a company like that, I think there's one thing we have to recognize is we didn't do the experiment of the, you know, we aren't able to engage in the experiment where we say, okay, let's imagine Apple and its success. And of course, it had periods of intense failure as well. But let's imagine a company like Apple with a leader who actually is interested in what others are thinking and doing. Now, that doesn't mean that person turns over the reins of the company to others' whims. No, but is deeply interested in creating an environment where people are bringing their best ideas forward. How confident are we that wouldn't be even better than what we saw? And may not have gone through the, you know, those really dark periods. The other part is, in many ways, the faulty reasoning can be, you know, some companies, yes, some companies will do well because they have, you know, an incredible genius who just really had a better mousetrap, and or because they had a, you know, really a monopoly position on something people really wanted to buy, and or because, you know, they were in an industry where it's just easier to make money, right? So in other words, there are multiple factors that can explain success, and all you need is one, you know,
one pathway
situation. One path, yeah, right. Well, also, all you need is one situation where someone doesn't speak up about a risk that they see, or where one person designs deceit software for your company to suffer an enormous blow, right? So all things being equal, it's pretty hard to argue against the idea that you want people to feel able to come forward,
right?
Or you're at risk. It could be risk of, you know, a physical explosion, a chemical company. It could be risk of an embarrassing bit of news coming out, and so on and so forth, right? So in a knowledge-intensive industry context, you better be interested in what other people have to say. You better create the conditions whereby they feel able and even obligated to come forward with what they know, or you're at risk.
And I would double down on that and say, especially now when so many of the problems are multidisciplinary in nature, so many of the problems are you're in an ambiguous and uncertain problem space, that you have to be able to do that. Otherwise, you're dead in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Well, look, it's time for my favorite part of the show. Amy, you've gone through the tough challenge of writing several amazing books, so I think you'll appreciate this discussion. This is where we talk about one of the very, very best habits we can adopt today, and that is the habit of reading. I want you to think about the books you've really enjoyed over the years, or books that have impacted you deeply. What are the two or three books that stand out for you?
Well, I think given the topic area that we've been discussing, the books that naturally come to mind are management related. And one that I think consistently needs more attention, it's just absolutely one of my favorite and highest impact business books that very few people, I think, Well, let me back up. Let me say that differently. One of the books that really stands out for me that you may not have heard of is called Get Rid of the Performance Review by Sam Culbert.
Yeah.
Now, have you read it?
I haven't, but I was intrigued because our organization, the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory, we went away from performance evaluations a few years ago, and it was like you would have thought we were setting fire to the building. People were apoplectic.
Exactly. Yeah, well, it's a fantastic book. And of course, the title is deliberately provocative because ultimately, if you read the book, you will see that this isn't about, certainly not about getting away from evaluation altogether. We all need evaluation to grow and learn. But the point it makes, and it makes it beautifully, and it's by Sam Culbert, who is a professor at UCLA. The point it makes is that the way most performance reviews are handled in most organizations is a sham. It's enormously ineffective. The process is enormously ineffective in getting the results it purports to want. And it's not a place of honesty or straightforwardness. It's a place of sort of unilateralism. And I won't do it justice in this short time, but it's well worth reading the critique of the way the process is usually handled. And then even more well worth reading what Culbert proposes instead, which he calls the performance preview. And metaphorically and even literally, it involves getting on the same side of the table and looking forward. Mm. You know, that instead of here, I'm the boss and I'm going to evaluate how good you are or not good you are, and I have all the answers, which is bunk, we are looking forward and saying, what do you need to be effective in helping accomplish these aims that, you know, we're responsible for accomplishing? And then what do you need from me? And how can I be, that's my job, right? How can I be effective in creating the conditions whereby you can be the very best version of yourself? You know, so there's a mutualism, a bilateralism that says it's my responsibility as the manager to figure out how to most effectively manage, right? I'm not supposed to just be a judge. I'm supposed to be a supporter, a helper, mm-hmm. a kind of perspective giver. And it's a little bit irreverent, but an absolutely remarkable book with very deep psychological insight. The second one that is an old favorite for me and not entirely unrelated is called Leadership and Self-Deception. The author is the Arbinger Institute, so they're so humble they don't even put a person's name on it.
Heck with it. We're just going to call her. We're going to go by the Institute.
The Institute, and it's a very beautiful book about sort of learning and humility and growth, but it's told as a novel. I'm not going to say it's great fiction, but it is great philosophy and great leadership depth.
Okay. I would lay money that our executives, our leadership, were reading that first book as they made the decision. We moved from a very, to what you said, kind of a very one-sided, unilateral to, but also it was like once of the year, right? You meet maybe twice in the year and to a more of a conversation-based performance. And it was one around like, look, let's not make this just a one or two times thing. Let's make this a more regular occurrence. Let's make this a more co-creative, collaborative experience. Grow the pie versus take my pie slice.
And that's more agile too, right? If we're going to meet once a year and sort of tell me all the things I did badly, that's not going to be as helpful as if we're sort of engaged in constant feedback loops.
Well, and then the I'll say to be on topic too, the great thing about pursuing that approach is that it allows the organization to grow more psychological safety with their people, because now mm-hmm. they're having real meaningful conversations with people that care, or at least should, about their career and their development. And you can have more of those honest conversations versus, you know, once or twice a year, you're just trying to figure out how can I look absolutely the best I can look in this one instance.
Right. And the stakes are too high. And so then the openness is too low.
Exactly. Final question. What's next for you? What are you really excited about? I know you have the book tour and the book launching, but I'll say yes, and, you know, in addition to that, what else are you excited about?
Well, you know, I've done all this research and I'm excited about the book being available and out there. And I hope people will we'll read it and learn from it. But what I'm really excited about is, okay, I've done this research, I'll continue to do research, but more and more I want to be doing the kind of research that's, how do you change things, right? And how do you, you know, what tools and techniques for change really work? Mm. What tools and techniques for engaging people in their own and their organization's learning really works? And this is a more, you know, action-oriented research approach. I'm excited about teaming up with other people who know other things, both in academia and in the workplace setting, to try new things and see what works.
Love that. Well, Amy, this has been a fantastic, fantastic conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time to share with us the goodness from both of your books, from your research. I'm walking away with some concrete things that I can do and take with my team.
Great. It's been a pleasure.
This is just a reminder that today's episode was sponsored by Tom Hefner Enterprises Innovation Training. If you love today's topic of teaming with Amy, and you want to improve your own teaming and collaboration in your organization, then be sure to check out this innovation training program. You're going to walk away from day one, with concrete tools to make your teaming more effective. Just head over to tomhefner.com/work to connect with Tom and learn more. You can connect with Amy online through LinkedIn. All the links and resources Amy and I discussed, including a link to her new book and her TED Talk, can be found at the page created just for this episode. You'll find it all at nextyearnowpodcast.com/62. And finally, just a reminder, if you like the show and enjoy learning from our guests each week, please consider giving us a rating and a review on iTunes. It really helps us stay relevant and findable by listeners like you. That's it for today. I'll see you next time.